Welcome to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, in for Mindy Todd, and I'm particularly excited to be here for our monthly roundup of all things birds and birding. Here with me is Mark Faherty, Science Coordinator for Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Mark, good to see you.
Good morning, Heather.
Okay, I'm hoping you can settle a debate that we've had going on in the newsroom for like a week,
which
is, what is the definition of an ornithologist? Do you have to have a degree in ornithology to call yourself an ornithologist?
It tends to be very loosely defined on the radio, I find.
Guilty as charged.
Well, you know, if someone knows more than birds than other people, people will call them an ornithologist. I think an ornithologist is somebody who studies birds in a sort of academic way and probably should be publishing papers and things like that. And I'm pretty much a slacker in that regard. So, you know, bird expert, my field of interest has always been bird ecology. And really just wildlife ecology. I'm not, you know, I love everything. I love all wildlife and always have since I was a kid. And bird ecology, wildlife ecology deals with the relationship between animals and their environment and their habitats and that kind of thing, and the way they interact with each other. Ornithologists, the ologies have kind of an old school kind of zoology connotation, like someone who, you know, sorts bones and looks at the physiology of animals.
Yeah, I was going to say more identification, physiology.
Right. It's sort of a different scale of organization within science where it's like the organism and then downwards to the, you know, the physiology of organisms and cellular things and things like that. So that's probably more of an answer than you wanted. But
all right. Well, whether you're an ornithologist, an ecologist, amateur birder, or a total novice like myself, we hope you'll join our conversation today. Tell us what you've been seeing and bring on the questions for Mark, not me. Our number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're going to be talking a lot about the fall migration of shorebirds, really getting into full swing this month. To get us in the mood, we've got a story about the Arctic tern. This tiny bird makes an incredible migration each year, traveling more than 50,000 miles from pole to pole. Ari Daniel shares their story with us.
Arctic terns, or Sterna paradisea, have stubby legs, so they're clumsy on land. But in the sky, that's a different story.
It's a very elegant bird in the air. It's made for life in the sky.
And, says Karsten Eggevang, a researcher at the Greenland Institute of Natural Resources, Arctic terns put that flying ability to good use.
It conducts this extremely long migration.
A migration from the Arctic to the Antarctic and back every year. Eggevang wanted to know more about that journey, how they get from the very north to the very south, and where they stop along the way. So in July of 2007, Eggevang headed up to Sand Island off the coast of Greenland. That's where he could find 1,000 breeding pairs of Arctic terns. His plan was to attach little geolocator bracelets to the legs of the birds to log their flight paths, but that was easier said than done.
There was absolutely no protection towards storms, so we had some really, really bad weather where our tents blew into the sea.
Wait, your tents blew into the sea? Didn't you need those tents to sleep?
Yeah, they'll get just devastated by the storms.
And if the cold and wet weren't enough, and the noise, they were also under attack.
The Arctic terns are very good at defending their colony, so they would attack us all the time from behind where you didn't notice them. And pick us in the head with their really pointy beaks.
And yet, despite the frosty elements and getting hammered in the back of the head over and over again by the very birds he was trying to study, Eggevang was able to set up a handful of traps.
Trap that we would place over the nest, and once the bird comes back to incubate the eggs, the trap will catch the bird and we're able to handle the bird.
Eggevang managed to trap 50 Arctic terns and attach the bracelets to them. And within days, the birds took off in small flocks and began their migratory odyssey. To retrieve the data, Eggevang had to get those geolocators back. So he waited a whole year for the birds to return. And when they did,
we would look up in the air at several hundred birds at the same time and look for that one bird that would have a small log on the leg. So that was really time-consuming.
Eggevang would track the bird back to its nest and set up that same trap to retrieve his geolocator.
Well, we are really far away into the Greenland wilderness, so we don't have all that much to celebrate with. apart from a bottle of whiskey. So we had a whiskey when we caught a bird.
All told, he tagged 10 birds and drank 10 shots of whiskey. He expected to find the birds would be in a hurry to get where they were going. But after leaving the breeding grounds, the birds spent a month hanging out in the middle of the North Atlantic.
This was completely unknown that the birds would do that.
Most of what's driving their migratory path is food, so they hang around spots where there are lots of small fish to eat. They start flying south again in September.
And then something really surprising happening around equator.
There's a migratory divide, a split.
About half the bird would follow the coast of Africa, whereas the other half would cross the Atlantic and then follow the coasts of South America. But all of them came back to spend the winter in the Weddell Sea down at Antarctica, where they will find an iceberg and rest and just fish and eat.
From November to April. And then within a week, all the birds take off to begin their northward return flight.
Instead of following the same routes as they did when they migrated south, they would pick a totally different S-shape pattern, flying towards Africa, crossing the equator, and then reaching almost as far as the Caribbeans before they would start flying towards Greenland.
The birds were able to take advantage of a strong tailwind, so they covered a lot of ground, over 300 miles per day.
It's like the birds were in a hurry to get back to the breeding grounds, and they more or less just went as fast as they could.
He can say something now about hotspots in the ocean, places that are especially rich in food, not just for Arctic terns, but for other seabirds and marine mammals, too. That can be helpful in deciding which parts of the ocean require extra conservation attention. And Egevang has calculated that all the flying an Arctic tern does during its life,
it's equal to if the Arctic terns were to fly to the moon and back three times. That's really amazing if you look at it that way.
What's amazing to me is that the birds, they really have to be adapted to the whole globe.
That's true.
So do you have new respect for these birds after seeing the results?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are really, really tough small birds.
And because of where Arctic terns spend their time, says Egevang, in a year they not only see more of our planet, but also more daylight than any other creature on Earth. Don't forget to visit EOL.org, where you can find a Google Earth tour of our story. It's got images and videos of the terns and animations of their flight paths driven by Egevang's data. Our series, One Species at a Time, is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
We'll have a link to that Arctic tern migration video that Ari refers to at our website as well. That's capeandislands.org. With me here in the studio is Mark Faherty. Mark, you were saying that despite the name Arctic tern, we used to have a lot of Arctic terns right here in Massachusetts, but the numbers are down.
Yeah, that used to be a kind of a smaller component of our big tern colonies that have always been mostly common terns and roseate terns. But Arctic terns used to be, you know, in the mix, and there would be hundreds of them in some of the really big tern colonies. And they've declined to the point where there's literally one left.
One.
Like, not one pair, like one Arctic tern. He's sort of the last of the Mohicans. And
he's had to get a little creative.
Yeah. Right. So we were just hearing about him at a meeting yesterday of all the folks who work with piping plovers and terns in Massachusetts and in New England. And so this last remaining Arctic tern has been paired with a common tern.
So not been paired in the sense that humans said, hey, why don't you try this? But they found each other.
Yes, they've in the biblical sense, they have known each other. And this has been the case for a few years. So this Arctic tern was just sort of flying around and calling, and there's no other Arctic tern. And went in Rome. And so he paired up with, I think it was a male, paired up with a common tern. And we were hearing about their offspring this year. And so this is something that makes bird watchers very nervous when you have two species that are not that easy to tell apart sometimes as it is. And now they're hybridizing and producing young that sort of look intermediate between a common tern and an Arctic tern.
And do we have any idea if they'll be viable?
they are viable because they've because these terns are so well studied. Biologists are in the tern colonies. They're banding individuals. They know individuals. They know their mates. They know who they mated with over the years. It's kind of like the humpback whales, right? When you go on the whale watches and they have the whales named and they know who their calves are. It's like that in these tern colonies because they're endangered and so they're very well studied. And so they know that offspring, hybrid offspring, common tern, Arctic tern, have actually mated back crossed with a common tern. And then they know what those offspring look like. And so this was an interesting presentation from Carolyn Mostello, who's a tern biologist with Mass Wildlife, you know, looking at how the intermediate plumage characteristics and that kind of thing. So it is a viable hybrid, and they can then either mate with, you know, other with common terns or Arctic terns again, and then you get result. You know, it's kind of an interesting genetic case study.
So evolution you get these back crosses. In process,
right? And it's not a common thing. They've coexisted for years.
No pun intended.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's nor is it an Arctic thing. It's kind of both. But it's not common for them to hybridize. Even though they co-occur in colonies. So it's really in these rare circumstances where there's just no other Arctic tern. And this bird was like, okay, you love the one you're with, you know.
All right. So it's only August. I hate to think about the fact that this might be the end of summer, but the fall migration for a lot of these birds is already getting underway, not just the Arctic terns, right? Who's starting to move?
I'm that guy who starts using the F word in fall. The F word is fall, right? Don't worry, it's okay. Yeah. Dan's got his finger on
it. We don't need to bleep it out, yeah, but yes.
The sensors are on the job. But
It might just be a four-letter bad word, yes.
It is. And so I start using that in July because that's when fall migration starts for shorebirds. So, you know, most of the shorebirds that we see here don't nest here. They nest in the high Arctic, or at least the Arctic, a lot of them in the high Arctic. So they're up there for really the month of June and maybe a little bit of July, and they're taking advantage of that short Arctic summer, but they don't stay there very long. Take a red knot, for example. The female red knot will migrate 3 days after the chicks have hatched. And so the chicks are still fuzzy little things dependent on at least one adult to protect them. They can feed themselves, but they haven't grown any feathers yet. They can't fly. And the female's like, I'm done. And she's already migrating. And this is true of a lot of shorebirds where the females will migrate before the young have fledged. So the adults have a strong incentive to get out of town quickly and start their migration because it's, for a lot of them, a long, perilous migration. You know, a red knot might be going from the Arctic Circle to Patagonia. You know,
that's and just incredible. To
unlike
think about.
These Arctic terns we just heard about, they can't land on the water and rest and have a meal. They have to fly nonstop over the water for days sometimes to get where they're going. And so I think it benefits them to leave early and get to certain staging areas where they can really fatten up, places that the species has learned collectively over the years that there are good resources to fatten up on. You know, mussel spat in the case of Cape Cod and red knots. They like to eat little baby mussels here in places like Pleasant Bay, in Chatham and other parts of Pleasant Bay. And that fuels them on their migration to literally the southern end of South America.
Yeah. I mean, I know the spring migrations, there have been some shifts in when migratory species, birds in particular, are arriving in New England as a result of climate change. Are we seeing the same thing on the fall end? I mean, if these red knots are only in the Arctic for a month, are we seeing that time shortening, lengthening, changing in some way?
Yeah, I haven't seen as much about the fall. You're right. The focus has been on the spring, and the spring is more critical. So spring migration is more protracted, and you heard a little bit of that in that Arctic tern story. In spring, birds are a little more serious, right? There's more at stake. They have to get somewhere at the right time to get a hold of the right resources to breed and reproduce themselves. Their entire raison d'etre as a biological species is to reproduce themselves. And so they can't screw around in the spring. They have to do things right, get to the right place at the right time. And often migrations are very quick in the spring. In the fall, birds, especially young birds, have time to kind of wander around, you know, find themselves, do a little backpacking. So fall migration is more more protracted. It's over a longer period. And so I would think that precise timings would be harder to nail down and relate back to climate change. Not to say that couldn't happen. I just haven't seen that. But it's definitely the signal is definitely there in spring for songbirds, and it's there in shorebirds as well. And we talked about a little bit about this on another show with Mindy, but there's this study of black-tailed godwits, which is a beautiful shorebird in Europe. And wicked rare over here, but it's more common in Europe, and you can see them in the UK in migration, and they breed in Northern Europe. And, you know, they're really into birds in Europe. And so there's a good long-term data set just from average birders seeing black-tailed godwits in the spring and, you know, noting when they see their first one and identifying individually banded black-tailed godwits. So it had this great long-term data set that showed unequivocally that they were showing up earlier on average in the spring. Like it used to be May and now it's April.
Big difference.
Not a full month difference, but like a couple of weeks at least. And that's a big difference biologically. But, you know, and that sort of makes sense. Oh, they're coming back early. But how do they know it's warmer where they're going, right? You know, they're coming from someplace further away. So the mechanism of how this is acting on the birds has never been really clear. Like if you really think about this, and it turned out that it was really only the young birds that were able to come back earlier. An individual bird, when they track, you know, they might live 20 years, does not change its migration timing at all over the course of its life. It'll show up on about the same day,
just totally hardwired
on its first year as it does 20 years later. So climate change isn't acting on individual adults year to year. Turns out young birds are hatching earlier because of climate change. The adults are able to nest earlier. And then these birds that are hatching earlier are then returning earlier in the spring. And then they keep that earlier migration throughout their life. So the climate change is acting on the young birds in their first year.
It's kind of an intergenerational.
And that's where the earlier migration is happening. So that was kind of an interesting study, yeah.
All right, Mark Faherty is Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary Science Coordinator. He's here talking birds with us this morning. I'm Heather Goldstone in for Mindy Todd, and we're looking for your questions and observations. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. And with me today is Mark Faherty, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. We're talking birds, and we hope you'll join us. Tell us what your nest boxes have produced, and we also want to know what the hummingbirds are enjoying in your backyard. Give us a call at 866-999-4626. You can also email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, you were mentioning this coastal waterbird conference that you were just at and got some numbers about terns and plovers. How did this summer go for some of our endangered shorebirds and waterbirds?
Right. So this meeting is held every year at Cape Cod Community College in August, and I call it the Plover Monitors Support Group. And so for those of us who are in charge of managing beaches for beach nesting birds and people managing tern colonies and that kind of thing, it's we sort of get together and
a little bit of group therapy.
We hold hands and a little bit of group therapy. But it's great to go over the season because you kind of get into your own little world and you're a little part of, you know, the state that you're managing. And it's good to hear other people's stories about how their birds are doing and, you know, share management techniques and that kind of thing for protecting these birds. You know, the piping plover population has been doing very well in Massachusetts, and it's on the order of, I think this year it was like 657 pairs. It's not a lot. I mean, it'll never be a common bird, right? And the whole Atlantic coast population is, you know, less than 2,000, I think. And so as Scott Melvin, the late state zoologist, used to say, they're more rare than tigers. It's one of my favorite quotes of his. And, you know, on the global scale, it's a very uncommon animal. But in Massachusetts, they're doing well.
Lack of habitat? I mean, why are they so rare?
It's Right. It's partly very specific habitat requirements, and the fact that that habitat has been so altered by human development over time that there's kind of packed into a fragment of where they were formerly able to nest. They'll always be less common than they used to be because we like to be at beaches. I like to be at beaches. I'm sure you like to be at beaches. But it's about managing them correctly, protecting both the birds and allowing human recreation. And we've learned a lot about that, I think, over the years, how to do both well, keep people happy and keep the plovers happy as well. And they are, like I said, they're doing well in Massachusetts. Other parts of the range, not so well. New York and New Jersey are still sort of struggling in terms of their plover populations. And so coast-wide, the population is still struggling. But we just have a lot of places where they seem to be doing well. Oddly, the Cape is not one of them. We've been sort of slowly losing pairs of piping plovers, even at pristine kind of wildernessy sites. Don't have as many pairs as they used to, and they're moving off Cape for some reason, finding jobs. I don't know what's going on with these plovers, but if it's predation pressure or what. But the North Shore has shown an increase in plovers. The South Shore, the Boston area, has seen an increase in nesting piping plovers.
It sounds like they're looking for jobs. Yeah,
they are looking for jobs. It's always the economy, stupid.
Heading to the big city,
right? And so places like Revere Beach have been a growth place for the piping plover population in recent years. Revere Beach.
That is so interesting.
And it's a nice barrier beach when you look at it. I mean, you think of it as just this urban kind of wasteland beach, and you wouldn't think of it having much wildlife value, but it totally does. The plover population really burgeoned there over several years, and was the predators really didn't know about them. You know, they don't... There aren't a ton of coyotes prowling the beach there, and so they were producing a lot of chicks there at Revere Beach for several years. But then this year, the predators sort of caught up to them, and there was a pair of American kestrels, these beautiful small falcons, one of my favorite birds, and a bird that itself is declining, like precipitously. Kestrels are really in trouble, but they're doing well in urban areas like Revere, Lynn, you know, places like that around Boston. And this pair of kestrels, these beautiful little falcons, kind of hung out at Revere Beach and just feasted on plover chicks and tern chicks as well. And so that was sort of tough for the plover population. But, you know, that's how it goes. There are predators and prey out there, and sometimes the predators win.
You're listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. We're talking birds with Mike Faherty of Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. You can join us at 866-999-4626 or email us at thepoint@capeandislands.org. We want to hear about your rare sightings as well as what's going on in your backyard nest boxes. We've got a couple of emails here. Carl from Acushnet says, for a few days last week, I saw as many as 4 young orioles at a time at my grape jelly feeder. This week, I haven't seen any old or young. So where are they going? Where do they head to? And I always see ants in the jelly feeder. Do the orioles eat ants?
Well, they're gone. I don't know. It must have been something you said. Tragic. You have to be careful. They're very sensitive, orioles.
It's the wrong brand of grape jelly in the
feeder.
Yeah,
right. Don't get off-brand. Actually, no, store-brand stuff seems to be what they like. Orioles are early migrants. Baltimore Orioles, not quite as early as orchard orioles. They are gone really by September, heading to Central America where they spend the winter. Baltimore Orioles don't migrate quite as late, but they'll start dispersing. So they'll leave the neighborhood where they nested and just start kind of wandering around, sort of pre-migratory wandering. Or maybe your neighbor has a better jelly feeder. I don't know. I mean, could be some kind of a local phenomenon there. But
are the young ones really ready to?
Oh yeah.
To migrate at this point?
To move. They can fly. They've been independent in terms of being able to fly on their own for a while.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a few late nesters out there, but there have been fledged orioles able to fly on their own for, you know, a couple of months now. And so, you know, they're even the young ones are thinking about migration. And so, you know, they might just be starting that journey. And so they left your neighborhood. But there still should be orioles around this time of year. And maybe you'll get a new family group that'll move in and fill the void left by the other one. But yeah, things are moving around now, and it's not just shorebirds, songbirds. So if you go out at night now, I've been hearing these little calls that nocturnally migrating songbirds give. And this is one of my favorite phenomena in ornithology, is this nocturnally migrating songbirds. And if you have good ears and you go out at night on a quiet night, maybe there's light northwest winds would probably be ideal, clear night, and you hear these little you're just little nothing kind of calls. If you tune your ears to this, you realize that there's this chorus of flight calls being given by warblers, tanagers, thrushes. Probably the most common thrush is the Swainson's thrush, and they make a flight call. It kind of sounds like a spring peeper. So, I'm not doing a very good job here.
A quiet whistle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a little peep kind of sound, a little upslurred peep. And again, if you tune your ears, you become aware of this river of migrating birds. If it's a really good night, like in September, the numbers will go up. But even now, it's happening, and so songbirds are migrating, and you can hear that.
Well, I have to say, I actually camped out in the backyard with my kids over the weekend, and went into the house about 6 o'clock in the morning to try to get some real sleep, mm-hmm. and and was struck by how quiet it was in the house. Just that I hadn't been thinking about it, but laying out in the backyard for several hours, the bird sounds, it was really quite loud, and to go into the house and just realize all of a sudden it was so quiet.
Right. Yeah. Even now, it's the birds are loud. They're not singing as much as they were in June, when they're defending territories and getting their nests ready, and so it's gotten a little bit quiet, but there's still a lot of bird sound, and there's that added bird sound of all night long, you know, in the middle of the night, just warblers that are on their way from Canada to Costa Rica, just passing over the Cape and just making a few little calls on their way. And there, researchers have been looking at this for years. A guy named Bill Evans, who used to be at Cornell, sort of pioneered building your own microphones for listening to this. And he has these great, you can go to his site, oldbird.org, and he has these great old plans that haven't been updated in years. And it's like, go to Kmart and get yourself a plastic flower pot and a Radio Shack microphone element, and so you plastic dinner plate, some like saran wrap. I mean, these are the things that he would make his first microphones, and he used to run them into a VCR, and then later extract the sound off of the VCR tapes. Now, that's, you know, great. Everything's digital, and there's software. It goes right into a computer, but people are listening to the night skies and quantifying what is migrating over. And you can do that by looking at the sonograms and identifying what species are making the calls. And more people, like amateurs, are doing this now. And they're starting to post their sightings on bird sightings websites like eBird, which is sort of the global, it's the universal site used by birders now to document your record your sightings. And people are starting to put their nocturnal migration recording results on there. And it's pretty cool stuff.
All right. We want to hear what you're seeing and hearing. Give us a call at 866-999-4626. Tell us what's going on with your backyard nest boxes, what they produced this year. And also, Mark, you wanted to hear about hummingbirds. And we have an email from Susan. Is it too late to have hummingbirds at my feeder? I kind of hope not. We've had one
it's
in our yard.
Late. Yeah.
Just one, but all summer. But yeah, he likes to come and visit our feeder, and also a couple of these.
Is it a male?
I think so.
Male just looks like it has a dark throat. And if you catch it right, you get that real ruby, that iridescent.
It's kind of greenish, and it's got the real ruby, really dark ruby throat. And it loves, we've got a couple of kind of trumpet-shaped, it's not actually a trumpet vine, but we've got another shrub that's got these dark red, kind of almost crimson trumpet-shaped flowers. And
is it
all
a honeysuckle?
Over those. No, it's not. You know, I've never been able to figure out what it is other than it's invasive.
Oh, all right.
It's one of the few invasives we still have hanging around our yard.
Send me a picture of that. I'm not sure what that is, but there's my favorite hummingbird plant. There's a few. There's a native honeysuckle vine. They call it coral honeysuckle or sometimes trumpet honeysuckle. It's Lonicera sempervirens, and nurseries tend to have it. Most nurseries tend to have it, and it's a vine, so you'll want to put it somewhere sunny where it can climb up a trellis or up the side of your garage or something like that. And it will bloom multiple times over the course of a season, and it's got these tubular flowers. You know, people know what honeysuckle flowers look like. But get the native type that's as close to the original native type as possible instead of one of the cultivars. And it's these orangey-red tubular flowers. And hummingbirds just absolutely love it. You know, when mine is in bloom, they come and they visit methodically visit every single flower. And, of course, everybody's butterfly bushes are in bloom right now. And that's all bets are off when that's blooming. Hummingbirds love that. Butterflies love it. And it sort of flies in the face of a lot of the advice you get on, you know, websites about using native plants and that kind of thing. And native plants are the way you want to go. But the reality is species don't care whether something is native or not native. There's a lot of people who say, well, you know, our plants and our insects and hummingbirds, our butterflies, they prefer native species. Well, they do until they don't, and it's they just want something to eat. And so butterfly bush is native to Eurasia, but it's the absolute most popular thing for butterflies and hummingbirds and bees to some extent in my yard, even though it's from Eurasia. It has some potential to be invasive as climate change continues in Massachusetts. It's not yet. But these things are just looking for a drink, you know, and if it's a non-native species that fills their needs, then they'll go for it.
We used to have a trumpet vine in our yard, and it was a big, woody, almost tree.
Right, trumpet vine is another common one. That's something different. Yeah.
And the hummingbirds, I mean, absolutely loved that, literally ate it up. We'd get three or four in this one bush. It got blown over by a hurricane, and we've been fighting it ever since because it wants to try to climb up under the siding of our house when it sends off shoots. But apparently it's, I mean, is it native, not native?
Right. So trumpet vine is something different than what I had been talking about. Trumpet vine is really common. Those big orange tubular trumpet bell looking flowers. It's really common around here. A lot of people seem to plant it by their mailbox somehow. It's a vine, but it can form hedges.
Yeah, that's the original one we had, like I said, was like a woody hedge.
Right, but it's a vine. It's native to the eastern U.S., but further south. But it does very well, at least in eastern Massachusetts. And that is one that hummingbirds and orioles love them, too. My brother lives in outside of Boston, and he's always talking about how his orioles do something called nectar robbing, where they pierce the side of the trumpet vine flower, or trumpet creeper is another name for it. They pierce the side and get at the nectar without going in the front because it's too long of a flower for their bill.
Hmm.
And this is something that birds do. It's a real thing, and it's called nectar robbing. And there are birds in the tropics that really make a living doing that. And it's called nectar robbing because they're subverting the whole pollination system that plants evolved, you know, to attract.
That you would have to go in the front and pick up some pollen in order to get the nectar.
Exactly, right. And so they're subverting the system. They're going in through the side and getting the nectar without performing any kind of a pollination service. And there are birds in the tropics that are called flower piercers that make a living doing that. And orioles, you can see orioles doing that right in your own backyard if you watch.
All right, I'm going to have to get some of that trumpet vine back in my yard. You are listening to The Point. That's Mark Fay, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. We have apparently been having some phone problems, but the phones are back. So tell us what your nest boxes have been doing and what the hummingbirds are doing in your yard. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll take your calls and talk more after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone in for Mindy Todd. My guest is Mark Fayerty, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. We're talking birds, and we're looking for your calls. Our number is 866-999-4626. We were having some phone problems. The phones are back, so if you tried earlier and couldn't get through, again, it's 866-999-4626. Mark, last month, you and Mindy talked about this bar-tailed godwit that had been seen in Chatham. Still there? Still hanging out? What's the latest with that one?
I don't think we did talk about it. The way I remember it was I literally learned about it right after we went off the air.
Maybe it was one of your weekly reports.
I did a weekly bird report, yes. And so this was a really cool bird. And it turned out it had been around for a while, and some kind of less experienced birders weren't sure what it was, and they had these blurry, distant photos. And They thought it might have been a marbled godwit, which is also rare but much more expected, gorgeous big sandpiper that we sometimes see. And then others just identified it as, I don't know, shorebird species. And then Blair Nicola, who has been birding on the Cape for, you know, multiple decades and is really incredibly knowledgeable. And he has found most of the rare shorebirds. He used to take his little skiff out to South Beach and Chatham all the time and come back with some Eurasian, you know, a redneck stint or some crazy shorebird from Asia that shouldn't be here. And so he was always that guy. And so he followed up on this. It turned up at Mass Audubon's Tern Island Sanctuary in Chatham. Incidentally, I'm leading a trip there this afternoon to look for shorebirds.
All right.
But it turned up there, and he was able to get some photos of it and figure out that this was a bar-tailed godwit. So this is, you know, a Eurasian species that also nests in Alaska.
He's way off track. I mean, he's supposed to be over on the West Coast in the Pacific. And
right.
Somehow he's here on the Cape.
And there are a number of records because we have such good shorebird habitat here and we have a lot of birders who check that good shorebird habitat that we have found a number of these over the years, but they don't turn up every year. You know, years go by where no one ever finds one. And the claim to fame for these guys is that they are the longest distance nonstop migrant animal, not bird, but animal in the world, and that they can't eat or stop and rest. So
they've even got the red knot beat.
They've got the red knot beat. They've got the Arctic tern beat because Arctic terns can land on the water. They can grab some sushi, you know.
Cheaters.
Right. They're seabirds. They're at home on the sea. But this is a shorebird. They can't land on the water. They don't have webbed feet. And so the bar-tailed godwit, and they've learned this from some satellite tracking studies, they fly nonstop from Alaska to New Zealand. It's like 7,000 miles or something like that.
Way better service than you can get on any airline.
That's right. Yeah. There are no in-flight peanuts, I can tell you that much. I mean, these birds, they have to put on prodigious amounts of fat and use that to fuel just flapping for like 8 days at a time.
So they have a much better excuse than I do for their summer binges.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we've got a lot of folks on the phone here. Kate is calling us from the road. Kate, I hope you're being safe. What's your question? What's on your mind?
I'm very safe, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you that I had seen a hummingbird yesterday in Bee Balm.
Oh, good. Yes. One of my favorites.
Love that. But also, I always see them in the Crocosmia. Is that the correct?
Yeah.
That's a little red trumpet.
Yep. That's a showy, kind of, it's not a native, but it's not invasive. It's a beautiful perennial in the lily family, sort of short blooming, but gorgeous red tubular flowers. And that's another thing I learned from my brother. Right. Hummingbirds love it. Crocosmia, yep. But
I just wanted to ask, I heard you say that the males have that ruby throat. And so if I didn't really see the ruby throat and perhaps the bird is a little smaller, is that the female, a little darker?
No, there's no size difference. The only difference is the throat. They both have a shiny green back. And everywhere I've been, I see way more females than males at my feeders. But other people get males. And the male, you catch a quick glimpse at him, it's just going to look like he has a dark throat. But if he lands on the feeder and the angle of the sun is right, the color on the throat of a hummingbird is produced structurally. It's not pigment-based color. And so the angle of the sun has to be right. And then you see that shimmering ruby-colored throat of the male. But otherwise, it might just look dark. And that's the difference between the males and
I
the females.
Maybe because there wasn't a lot of sunlight. Maybe I just wasn't seeing it.
Right.
Hard to see that. Kate, thanks for your call.
So I'm glad you mentioned bee balm just before we move on, and that's one I wanted to mention. And that's a native kind of eastern U.S. prairie species, bee balm. And the one that seems to be best for hummingbirds, a lot of people have bee balm in their yards, the red ones, beautiful tubular red flowers. It's in the mint family. And Jacob Klein bee balm are the big red ones. I haven't had great luck growing them. Other people say they're invasive in their yard, so you get mixed results with them. But it's an eastern U.S. native that hummingbirds absolutely love.
I mean, it seems like pretty much anything red and tubular is the way to go.
Yeah, they like things totally tubular, these hummingbirds.
Sherilyn is calling us from Dennis. Hey, Sherilyn, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoyed your program so far this morning.
Oh, well, thanks for calling us.
Yeah, thank you. So I just have a question about the American oyster catcher, because I saw one down in Chatham, and I was fascinated by it. And, you know, the ladies at the refuge center said it was they were fairly common, but I've never seen one, and I just wanted to know how common they are.
They're common in Chatham. Chatham is Chatham and the islands are the best places to see oyster catchers. The biggest breeding populations are on Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and Monomoy, and other spots in Chatham. And so places like Turn Island and Chatham is a great place to see. I've seen as many as 18 of them hanging out there. And sometimes you can see those from Cowyard Lane there in Chatham, or the Fish Pier, or the Chatham Fish Pier. But certainly...
Yeah, I was on Morris Island.
Morris Island is the next place I was going to mention, where the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge headquarters are. And that's a great place to see them, sometimes distantly on the flats, but sometimes closer. They're just such a cool bird. I mean, you don't have to be a birder to appreciate an American oyster catcher. It's just big, crazy-looking...
No, not at all.
Big red bill.
I was going to say, yeah,
they're loud.
The bill that's so colorful, and they're just fun to watch.
And they have great behaviors, so they interact a lot and sort of yell at each other, and they do these displays where they toss their heads back and make these really loud calls. But their feeding behaviors are cool. So they're eating shellfish, mostly mussels and clams in this part of the world. They wait till the winter down in the southeastern U.S. before they get into oysters. But when they're eating clams and mussels, they have to open them, right? And so some birds will go in through the hinge and they'll cut the adductor muscle. Other birds will just sort of blunt force trauma. Oh, nice. Nice work, Dan. That's oyster catchers interacting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have this, when they fly around, they just give this loud So some will go in through
bird.
The adductor muscle.
How popular
others
are they in the world? I mean, like how common? I mean, are
they're more common further south. We're getting towards the northern end of their breeding range here, but you can go to a Florida beach in the winter, beach on the Cape Hatteras or something like that, and see maybe dozens of them. In Massachusetts, they're a little more scarce, but like I said, Chatham and the islands are your best bets for seeing numbers of them.
All right, Sherilyn, thanks for giving us a call. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. If you've got a question for Mark Faherty or an exciting observation to share with us, you can also email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Bob is calling us from Norwalk. Hi, Bob.
I'm not familiar with that part of the Cape.
Good morning. It's actually Norfolk, Mass, over by Foxborough, Plainville area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
So what's on your mind?
To butterflies.
Good.
Butterflies.
I have the old-fashioned milkweed.
Yeah.
And I've got tons of it. And I've been beating it back for about 11 years, but I don't want to get rid of it because I understand that's what the monarch butterflies, their only food.
Yes.
For 11 years, I've yet to see. I see monarchs come and go, but I never see the chrysalis or the caterpillars or anybody eating it.
Yeah.
That's just... Failed? Are they not? Do they not eat around here? Do they not lay eggs around here?
No, they absolutely do. But the caterpillars can be surprisingly hard to find. I'm constantly checking milkweeds, and so the milkweed you're talking about, I'm sure, is common milkweed. And so this is the familiar,
the old fashioned sandlot milkweed. Gets as tall, 6 feet tall.
It's old fashioned, I guess. It grows out of cracks in concrete. I mean, I was just at Cape Cod Community College yesterday, and they have a lot of it there. And it's literally growing out of cracks in the con- it's a sidewalk weed. And so people talk about, well, there's not enough milkweed for or the monarchs. And I don't think that's really true of the eastern U.S. In the Midwest, where agriculture has displaced big areas of prairie, yes, there's definitely not enough milkweed for the monarchs going up and down through the Midwest. Here, we probably have plenty. And so you probably just have to keep looking, and eventually you'll find a caterpillar. Because they do use it. But here's the thing. There are multiple kinds of milkweed. And so those of us on the Cape are probably familiar with butterfly weed, the orange one.
Right.
And that's Asclepias tuberosa that likes dry, sandy places. They'll lay their eggs on that. But there's also swamp milkweed. And this is one that anyone can buy at a nursery. Yeah. It's a common nursery plant. It does well in gardens. And research has shown that in the East, the monarchs prefer to lay their eggs on swamp milkweed. So if you put that in your garden, that might even be better than letting your common milkweed go wild. It can be kind of invasive. I mean, like I said, it's a sidewalk crack weed.
I could take out 10 wheelbarrows a day out of my property as soon as I
Well, you could bring it over to my house then.
Me too. I want some,
too. This is one of those things where I can't seem to get it. It's a weed and I can't get it to
grow. I've had trouble establishing it. But once you do get it established, you will probably have to be – you'll be having to pick it and kind of beat it back, as this guy said. But try some swamp milkweed in your garden. It does very well. Even that can be aggressive in the garden. But they love it. They'll lay eggs on it. It's a beautiful flower. And the thing about milkweeds, people focus on the fact that monarchs lay their eggs on it, but the flowers are among the most popular nectar sources for all kinds of pollinators. Every butterfly, every bee, you know, small bees, big bees, everything, you know, wasps, they all love milkweed flowers. And they're beautiful flowers. So it's sort of a double threat. You know, it's a nectar source and it's a host plant for monarch caterpillars.
You know, somebody recently said to me, well, the monarchs really prefer the young ones. And so the best thing, if you've got a whole bunch of milkweed, is mow it and let it, you know, midsummer and let it come back up. So is that really?
Well, yeah, I would mow some of it. If you have a lot, trim some back so that it's smaller and more tender. In late summer when the monarchs are coming through. So that last generation they produce is the one that has to fly to Mexico. So the ones that are emerging in late August and September will fly from Maine or Cape Cod or whatever to Mexico. And so that last generation, if there's some nice tender young milkweed around that's been mowed or whatever earlier in the summer, they'll probably prefer to lay their eggs on that. So it probably seems counterintuitive to some people, like mow your milkweed in July, but if you mow some of it, then that can definitely help monarchs.
All right, Bob, thanks for your call. We've also got an email here from Phil who says, we've got a pair of hummingbirds that are feasting on the Rose of Sharon, the white flower variety. So there's another...
I have seen them at Rose of Sharon. And
totally breaking the red flower rule to have them at a white Rose of Sharon.
Yeah, it's not a rule. I mean, they're just... Well, here's the other thing. Young hummingbirds will... They'll stick their bill in anything. I mean, if you watch them, they'll come up and they'll practically put it in your ear because they're learning. I mean, they're learning what flowers are good and what aren't because they were fed by their parents. They didn't get to see what flowers their parents were visiting while they were in the nest. And so they go out into the world and then they have to sort of figure it out. And so you'll see them visiting, you know, the pansies on your deck. They're not getting nectar from those pansies. They're probably not getting, you'll see them probing into, you know, geraniums or something like that, or petunias. That's what I was trying to think of. You know, petunias are sort of robo plants, these annuals you get that they don't really produce nectar or pollen. But you'll see a hummingbird visit one and be like, oh, maybe it's a good hummingbird plant. That's probably a young one who's just sort of figuring things out. They don't know any better yet.
All right, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to make sure we mention these two white ibises that have been visiting the sanctuary in Wellfleet. So these are tropical birds, right? How unusual is this?
Yeah, that's a Florida bird, you know, Georgia, the Carolinas. These are the normal places, but especially Florida and the Everglades. It's an emblematic bird of the Everglades. And so you would see them if you went to Florida in the winter. They're really common. They're in parks and yards, but also out in the Everglades. And so Jeanette Bragger is one of our trail naturalists who will help you if you're on our trails, help you identify birds and things. And she came in, and I'm on the phone in my office. She shows me the back of her camera. There's a picture of two immature white ibises. So I hung up on whoever I was talking to.
And apologies to whoever that
was. Got the word out and went out there, and we found them again. And they've been there since that. It's over a week ago. And they're still there. They were there yesterday. And they're hard to miss. You know, they're big birds. They're the size of a great egret almost, and a big, long bill. And they're using that bill to eat fiddler crabs, which we have a bazillion of at the sanctuary. So come by, and the folks at the desk can tell you where they are. Come see our white ibises. Really
come
rare.
See the white ibises while they last. That's Mark Faherty, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Apologies for our phone issues this hour, and if we didn't get to your call, we do apologize. But thanks for being part of our conversation. I'm Heather Goldstone, in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.